It is class time once again. Everybody, please get your pencils, your writing utensils, and your notebooks out. We are headed back to class today. My better half, the heart, aww, soul, and whole of this podcast. He is the face of Historically High. He's the broken red eyes, the bloodshot eyes of Historically High. My co-host Chris, he's fresher than Mars Blackman.
I don't even know who that is.
The old Air Jordan commercials, Spike Lee?
No. Wait, I probably would recognize it if you showed to me.
Yeah, if you saw it, you'd know him. It's a little Mac Miller line. Let's listen to some Mac Miller today.
Well, thank you, kind sir. Like he said, we're back at it. Pens, papers, at the ready, whatever your preferred method of intake is. We're going international today. And we're going to be talking about something that I haven't had as a lifelong love, but have found myself very interested in over about the past 4 years.
And passion's it's a driving force to a lot of this stuff that we like looking into.
It's goddamn Netflix is what it is.
I could see that. Yeah. It's
like, you get those, it's the Tiger King shit. We're not talking Tiger King today, thank God. But of course, having always looked at the title of what you're going to be getting into, we're talking Formula One today. And Drive to Survive came at that perfect COVID time when everyone was wanting to binge shit.
It's that old?
Yeah, they're in their fifth or sixth season right now. Shit. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can thank COVID for the popularity of Rise in Formula One. But just, it's one of those things where, like, I come from a small town. My dad is into NASCAR. Like, like multiple shirts and everything.
Three's up for Dale.
I've been to a NASCAR race in Phoenix when I was, I think, maybe like 14, 15, maybe 16 years old.
Really?
And I'll even admit, it's like being there in the environment, it's fucking cool. Like the colors, the trailers, the fucking sound is fucking deafening, but like, it's crazy. Like motorsports are insane. And when it comes to motorsports internationally, there's nothing above Formula One. It's, I like to make the comparison that if sometimes you do just want a fucking burger, a fucking juicy, delicious burger, and that's your NASCAR. But other times, you want steak, you want that filet mignon, you want that nice tender cut, and that's going to be Formula One. It's a little bit more refined, there's a lot more to it. But again, I like to eat a burger every now and then, so I'm not, this isn't an episode just bashed on NASCAR. I'm just saying when it comes to the top tier, it's got to be Formula One.
I like my cars to be able to turn right and left.
These cars do turn right and left.
That's what I'm saying. The ovular nature of NASCAR just doesn't quite do it for me.
Like reverse, do they reverse the tracks ever?
And go the other way? Australia toilets go the other way? Do you think that
throws the fucking shit? They're like, my forearm to pull the wheel down is so much more developed. This right-hand course is fucking killing me. Well, yeah, with Formula One, they're definitely going up, down, right, left, any which direction, because there are like the courses that they're driving on are fucking like roller coasters. Yeah. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take you on what could be, known after this episode as an emotional roller coaster of sorts. Because there's a lot to this, buddy.
I like it.
So everyone strap in, throw on your helmets. We're getting balls deep into the beautiful sport of Formula One. Where does it start? I'm so glad you asked, Adam. Where did it all begin? You're over there grinding and getting stuff set up. I'm not dogging on you. I'm keeping the flow.
Part of the thing, you mentioned it, the intro, Drive to Survive almost seems like it set a precedent for, obviously we had Hard Knocks before that with football, but there's a PGA one that they put out on Netflix. I think it's
called Drive, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like a ripoff of what
we have Drive quarterbacks to Survive. Now.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
People have, I think, found with sports that the just stepping into something. I was listening to We Might Be Drunk.
Yep.
On the way over here. And Mark Norman and Sam Morrell were talking about how when Sam goes to like a Knicks game and they go with, I think it's Gary Beter, he will tell them the backstory of all of these players, where they went to college, if they'd been into shit, like where they've played, you know, professionally, if they've been traded, all this kind of stuff. And he's like, I pay a lot closer attention to this game because of that, because now I have some backstory. Now I can be invested in this.
Yeah, you can. It's almost, these guys are sitting in cars. So you exactly. have to kind of know who's in the cars. When you see them
on TV, when you turn into the event, that's it. They're just these guys sitting in cars, and you're like, well, RC cars. Like, you don't get the, you don't identify these as, like, real people. But once you break it down and you find out not only, like, how they got into these seats, but, like, the ages of these guys when they're given a fucking cockpit in F1, like, how they grew up, what it took for them to get to this level, and then the simple fact that, although there are lower, like almost what you would consider farm systems for Formula One, you basically have 20 guys, only 20, that are in these positions. It's, you know, when you break it down just to kind of set the stage, you have 10 teams currently in Formula One right now. Each team fields two drivers. You got 20 cars in each race. And so you have these guys that are the top 20 in their field. And once you start to kind of like learn about them, and that's the coolest thing with Drive to Survive, is that it takes you behind and you get to know not only like the drivers themselves and like kind of hear their stories, you kind of figure out like whenever NFL, European football, anything like that, baseball, you go to a home team stadium and everyone is cheering for that home team.
Mm-hmm.
On these races, people are almost like, you do have home races for certain manufacturers and certain cars, but you also have home races for drivers because these guys come from everywhere, that the entire stadium will be rooting for that driver, not the car that he's driving or anything like that. It's like that guy. And so you have fans of teams that are manufacturers, even a product you like or something that sponsors that team, but then you can also be a fan of driver and then move teams as those drivers shift seats.
So what you're telling me is I need a team. So we're going to have to get me figured out a team before we get
into this. No, or you can pick a driver.
No, I'm the drivers. I'm more of a team guy. I'm more what's on the front of the jersey than the back of the jersey.
Okay. Well, hopefully by the end of this, maybe we'll find you a team. You can find out who you identify with based upon their past successes and maybe kind of where they're going in the future.
We're about to find out right now, because my number one question, is there an Aston Martin team or an Alfa Romeo team?
There is both.
Fuck.
Yes.
Okay.
So
that made it tougher.
If you're basing it on drivers, Alfa Romeo has a guy named Valtteri Bottas and he's a,
is he Italian?
No, he is a Finnish dude.
Okay.
And he's fucking cool as shit from Drive to Survive. He used to drive, he was the number two driver or the other driver. Yeah, Mercedes, up until a couple years ago, he came over to Alfa Romeo where they promoted another driver up into his seat. And so if you're looking for Alfa Romeo, that's pretty badass. Aston Martin, their cars just look fucking incredible. It's this weird dark green that fucking has like ear. Like, so if you're looking at like the flash and you want that Aston Martin, and here's the thing. When you kind of find out about these teams, the names can also be misleading too, because you have teams like Red Bull and you're like, well, fucking Red Bull doesn't manufacture cars or engines. So, like, how the fuck is there? Do they just have a division for literally making Formula One cars? It's fucking fascinating how this shit works. And we're going to get into it. I want to go and provide a little bit of history on it so you know where we came from.
Okay.
So, the inaugural season was in 1950, but we're going to back it up just a little bit further to find out kind of how the origins of this happened. Before the FIA, which was the Federation de Internationale de Automobile, or Federal Internet, or International Federation of Automobiles, or
Federales.
Yes. I'm just going to refer to it as the FIA. So before they were around as a governing body, you still did have, it's the competition thing. As soon as automobiles and engines were a thing, there's been racing of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these precursors to what we know as Formula One that took place. And basically were considered these like European world championships, things like that. You had a thing called the European Grand Prix, which took place in the 20s and 30s. So you had like a callback to the fucking like Hitler episodes. You had times when Mercedes, which was, you know, a manufacturer in Germany pre-World War II, designing cars to compete against cars from France and Italy and the UK in these European Grand Prix.
What did they look like back then?
So back then, if you've ever kind of looked at old footage or if you ever go back, these are the ones where the engines were out front. They were still, it's always been open wheel racing. So the wheels have never been covered. That's kind of the thing kind of set it apart from like stock cars and stuff. So they call it open wheel racing. So you had like British manufacturers and ones that you may have never even heard of, but like Mercedes you've heard of, that were fielding these cars. And with all the research that fucking like Hitler and Germany were doing into like modernization for like warfare and vehicles and advancement, they fielded like the most dominant cars early on. They called them the Silver Bullets, and there's logos now on the Mercedes car, Mercedes, that they call like the Silver something. Oh, Silver Arrows. Sorry. They called countries' cars. Advertising, of course, wasn't a thing. So the cars were designated as representatives from their country. It wasn't like Red Bull or Mercedes and like stuff like that.
Okay.
So you had British cars that were green. They were always green. You had the Italians that were always red. And then you had the Germans that were always silver. Huh. So from the foundation of it, you had a lot of domination for like these German manufacturers and German cars.
Was it just Mercedes?
I think it kind of was primarily.
But as far as
like, it was fielding these cars, this thing was at a point where there were literally like 7 to 8 races, like very few races. Okay. It wasn't like, and it wasn't world. It was just a European thing. It was almost kind of determined that it was discovered in Britain for motor racing. And then other countries kind of started jumping in to field their vehicles as well.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, you had this domination essentially by Germans because they were advancing as far as like, you know, mechanized armies and stuff like that. So kind of takes and loses a little bit of priority during World War II, of course.
As most things.
Exactly. And the modern foundations were kind of set forth in like 1946 when the FIA basically was invented and then standardized some rules for this open wheel Formula One racing. I can't remember what the precursor name was. So there's some debate about what the actual first race was. So it was either the Turin Grand Prix in 1946, the 1947 Swedish Winter Grand Prix, which was driven on ice. And the argument against that one, they're like, well, it wasn't real road. They were driving on ice. I'm like, that should be the fucking first one.
It was a Mickey Mouse championship because it was on ice instead of asphalt.
I don't even know how that worked, but can you imagine just cut around course? Because those things were still moving at this time.
Well, even today, to see some of the conditions that they race in, it's like, this is the dumbest shit that I've ever seen.
Oh, when it's, when you can't even see the car rain in front of you, when they're just going in rain. Like, that's the difference too. Like, you look at like stock car racing, like NASCAR and stuff. They're like, well, it's raining and then they got to get the dryers out on the track. Yeah. Rain or fucking shine, unless there's some like hurricane warning, these things are racing and they call it racing in the wet.
Ooh.
Hell yeah. And then we get the, I think like the 47 Grand Prix, like the Pan Grand Prix. And that one is kind of recognized that one probably fits more of the mold for the standardization of it. But in 1950, that was the inaugural season when the world championship for drivers was kind of all put together and included 6 Grand Prix in Europe and weirdly enough, the Indy 500. They would come over and race. So it's always kind of had its foothold here. Formula One has stepped away from the United States at various times kind of during its life and everything. But yeah, early on, they would come over and they would race at the Indy 500.
Huh. So but it was just the oval track, right? It wasn't like a course?
I thought the Indy 500 was more of a kind of a square with 4 corners. We'll have to look into it a little bit more.
Yeah. But I've heard that's a fun place to be.
Oh, I would imagine, man. So the just to kind of touch on the Indy 500, you have the Indy 500, you have the the Monaco Grand Prix, which is Formula One, and then the 24-hour Le Mans are known as like the, like basically the triple crown of auto racing is what those three are known as. So early on, it was like the Italians that were just dominating straight out of the gate. You had Alfa Romeo, still a name. Yeah. It's kind of come and gone in Formula One.
Some of the most beautiful cars you will ever see.
You got Ferrari, which has never left Formula One since its inception. And then like Maserati basically dominated. And then Alfa Romeo actually won the first inaugural season. So in 51 or 50 and 51, Enzo Ferrari steps in and designs a new V12 engine. And if you've ever heard like highlights or like watched certain like just footage of like Formula One or anything, and it's like classic stuff.
Yeah.
The super high pitched engine, just the one that sounds like it's screaming and going to explode going down the track. That's like the V12s.
Well,
and there's a ton of drivers that'll be like, there's footage of drivers doing interviews. And during these race events, because these race weeks are literally like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday event.
Uh-huh.
During, you know, their time in the pits, they're always doing interviews with people leading up for like qualifying, and they'll bring out for like exhibitions, like these old F1 cars, and you'll hear them talking. And then all of a sudden you'll hear that whine in the background and you'll hear them be like, be quiet for a second. And they'll listen. They're like, oh God, that's the V12. You can't like they, part of like the highlight of their career is getting to drive. Like if they sign for a manufacturer or constructor, to go back and they get to drive some of these cars sometimes for exhibitions, and they just fucking love it.
That to me is such a wild thought, to think that it was a V12 engine. So yeah. You literally have a V with six cylinders on each side.
In the front of the car.
Yeah. It's
to aircraft, me, aircraft engine, bud.
Well,
like you're kind of like
your aircraft engines are like W12s now, right? Where there's the six cylinder.
I'm talking about like the World War II type ones.
Oh.
And everything. So, and I'm going to kind of go into that too. With like Ferrari designing this new V12 engine, apparently early on, the big thing was all about horsepower. Because that's what you figured, the more horsepower, the faster I can go, faster the times, so I'm going to win.
Very American-centric way of thinking.
A very Italian-American-centric way of thinking, yeah. More power. So the British cars were like, we can't fucking compete with this. Like, they've got this down to a science. So what they started working on is, because during World War II, they focused so much on the RAF and aviation, they were able to take all of this knowledge about aerodynamics and basically apply this to the cars in order to provide them more downforce, which meant essentially that they were able to take corners at much higher speeds and completely negate the additional power that these other vehicles had on the straights. So they were able to basically use, like, we can't beat them on power, but we'll definitely make it to where we can take these turns and maneuver a lot faster than them. So you already had this kind of, like, national rivalry, and it still exists today about, like, who's designing the best cars.
Weren't the British cars that were winning, like, Mini Coopers?
So there was actually in 58, I'll get to that in just a second.
Okay.
So Alfa Romeo ends up dropping out sometime in the early 50s because they were being funded by the Italian government. So you had a nationally funded team, and they basically, like, while they were being funded, they were such a small outfit, and we're going to kind of get into that with some of the smaller teams that compete today.
Yeah.
But they were basically able to win two championships on only eight engines. And there are some situations where these teams go through a ton of engines for, you know, development and testing and all that kind of shit. It was just fucking nuts what they did with so little. And then in 1954, they're always doing new regulations based on the technology that's coming out. It's constantly changing, even more so than I think most modern sports, because the advancements in automotive technology and shit, they're having to write rules for everything.
Well, and it's, compared to other sports, there's such minute details in the tuning of some of these engines.
Because there are standards that they have, there's like requirements they have to meet as far as standardization of certain size things, but we'll talk about the constructors things. These vehicles, it's not just like they're getting a part from this and there's a company that makes certain parts and then they're assembling, and because you order from this place, they make better parts and everything. The way that they construct these, and they call them constructors. So you have currently right now, and from a certain time point, I'll get to it a little bit later, you have the driver's championship, and then you have what's called the constructor championship. The driver one is the one you always hear about, the singular driver winning the, you know, Formula One. The Constructors Championship is actually where all of the money's at, because it's determined by your positioning and finishing in the constructor, your profit sharing from the FIA and from Formula One. So when you win a constructors, that's where all of your funding comes from. The drivers don't even get paid as any part of a driver's championship. There's no money to be made there. They're just simply getting paid by their team to assist in winning constructors championships. But they still making, you know, a shit ton of money.
So what's the difference?
From the drivers and the constructors?
Yeah.
So whereas when you have a driver's championship, the same amount of points are allocated.
Is it like different races, though?
Yes. So there's points to be won from each race. And then within the race, you can win like an additional point for like running the fastest lap. So kind of how the point system works, and this is going to be an episode of bouncing back and forth between stuff, but it's just a lot of info. You have two drivers for your team. And first place wins 25 points, second 18, third 15, fourth 12, 5, 10, 8, 6, 4, 2, and 1. So there's a huge gap even between first and second. That's the same amount of points you win as a constructor. So if you were to have a guy finish in first and third as a constructor, you're getting 25 points and 15 points that both go that go toward your constructor's points. Whereas upon your drivers are only getting 25 points and 15 points. So there's essentially two contests going on. But the whole point is you want two strong drivers because that's what's going to win you essentially the money.
Guys sitting higher up on the leaders board is going to benefit
a guy that's always
you.
Placing first and his teammate placing 10th. He may win the driver's championship and be the one that everyone's looking at, but
you're
because that guy's
dick
finishing
on the
down
back end.
As far as the funding that goes toward the next development of the car and everything like that, the guys that placed in second and fifth or second and fourth are going to win the constructors.
Yeah.
It's just weird how there's more prestige because it's one singular individual standing on that podium and you're not really kind of seeing like, yeah, the team's up there.
Huh.
So back in 54, with the new regulations, Mercedes comes in at the same time and basically take the next 2 years. So you're having these teams that are just literally coming in within their... It's complete opposite as it is today. You have these new teams that are coming in and basically just being dominant from the get-go. And then after that, 2 years later, or the 2 years that they win, Mercedes disappears from Formula One. And
is it just financial...
It can be so many different reasons. It's just you're not making the money back that you thought you were going to make. For Mercedes, it was a little bit different. There was a Mercedes that was involved in a wreck at Le Mans that wrecked and killed 83 people. Ran into the back of a smaller car, launched itself over the thing, and crashed into the crowd.
Probably need to lower your profile for a few years and let that one simmer.
Probably. I mean, you're being based out of, and I want to say it was West Germany, that where Mercedes was located, but you're coming out, so you're a German manufacturer. You are, if it's 54 that this happens, or sorry, yeah, if it's 54 if this happens at Le Mans, you're only sitting 8 years removed, and a German manufacturer has just killed 83 people. So they actually don't return for another 40 years into Formula One. As like a sponsor team, they do, however, in a weird way, and this is how complicated it gets, there are only certain engine providers. So a team like Red Bull, they get their engines from Honda.
Yeah.
So that's why it's Red Bull Honda. So like if you win the constructors, you always, and I'll kind of go into the details on what makes a constructor and what you have to do in order to be considered one. But it's crazy because you'll see like, four names on the winning and you're like, well, who the fuck is doing what?
It's a conglomeration.
It really is. And so after Mercedes disappeared, what you were talking about with the Cooper in 58, mid-engine Cooper. So the engine sitting behind the driver, it wins the Argentine Grand Prix. And it's the first, it doesn't win the whole thing, but it's the first rear engine to win. Well, when it's been dominated by nothing but these other cars, and all of a sudden this Cooper comes in and beats all this, it completely throws the way of thinking and planning on its head. It's like, well, obviously this is the best way to do it. And this guy named Juan Manuel Fangio won 5 championships between 51 and 57. I'm just going back to kind of let you know who the big drivers are at this point. He wasn't driving a Mini or anything like the rear engine, but that record stood for 46 years until we get to our boy...
Louis?
Michael Schumacher.
Oh, okay.
Yep, so it stood for 46 years until Michael Schumacher came in. 58 is the season when the Constructors' Championship was added. So now that adds an entirely new element of making sure you have a well-rounded team. Not just one driver that's winning and another one that's putting in the wall every race.
Probably the most important rule change they've ever made.
Yes, I think so. It's forward pass in football type stuff.
Yeah,
it completely changed the priority of the racing and how it was handled. So then you get in 61, by then, all the teams had gone to mid-engine cars. So within the course of 3 years, completely switching around the way the sport was run, all manufacturers are now doing rear-engine cars, and we see that still to this day.
I also think that it – not only does it make more sense, just because if you think of the way that cars are constructed, if you have a front engine car and a rear wheel drive, you have the drivetrain that has to run from the front of the car.
Longer drivetrain. You're losing power
over the back.
Yep.
Also, at the same time, something that they changed up in drag racing, they used to have the engine sitting in front for drag racing, but they realized that when you crashed in a dragster and the engine was in front of you, it was just coming back to meet your
maker.
It's
a weight thing, too. If you're thinking about a rear wheel, you're putting all the weight in the back, which means all the power, you're pushing it by the rear wheels. So if you have more weight and downforce in the back, it's putting more weight and you're able to go ahead and take corners at higher speed. It's kind of weird that it took them that long to figure it out. But I guess if, you know, everyone's looking at the racers that are dominant, it's front engine cars. They're like, we just have to try to do this front engine shit better.
Yeah. And I also think too, that it was sort of like we built cars one way for so long. It took a little while to reimagine. Like
you can never think. Yeah. Every engine was always in the front, even in all of our cars now, unless you get to high performance, like supercars.
Yeah. Or VW bugs.
Yeah. There you go. So
Ford, what was it? The Fiero?
I think that was also intended, but also the GT40, the Ford vehicle, or the Ford supercar that won Le Mans.
Pontiac Fiero.
Pontiac Fiero. There you go. There's a couple. So in 62, Lotus is like, all right, well, we're just going to make our car lighter. So we're going to start building an aluminum chassis. These are companies that are also looking to, like, you know, taking those cues from aviation, building it with lighter materials and all that shit. So that adds a new element. And now these cars are getting lighter, bigger engines, more speed. And one of the best things in 68, this is when sponsorship is introduced to the sport. And the first thing that latched onto Formula One was fucking Sweet cigarettes. This is where, if you're thinking of like classic Formula One, this is the fucking Marlboro fucking, you know, I think it was a McLaren one, but the first sponsorship was like cigarettes. And I think it was like they had changed because you're moving from like a manufacturer solid color to now you're sporting what they call the livery.
Yeah.
The livery is so fucking cool. Just to even think about that, the way the cars are designed and the color schemes that they used, it's like, well, that, you know, that doesn't matter much, but it's just fucking cool because like every couple years they'll change the livery and it'll come out, and there's so much research done into this for like what these things are going to look like, where to put all the product placement, the cost associated where these product placements are going, rear wing $50 million a year, front sport, like it's just fucking insane.
That's the other thing too that excuse me, I wonder, and maybe you know that it plays a factor in when they put cameras on turns, you probably have a more profitable side of the car, you would say.
Yeah, I mean,
if there's more like left turns on a track,
if you see footage, it'll do the driver cam, and it'll go back. And sometimes you'll see not only the fact that they have branding on their helmets, and everything. And I didn't get a solid fact on this, but I want to say that the car, all of that goes toward the sponsor manufacturer, whoever it is, the team. But I want to say I've heard the drivers get choice on what they advertise on their helmets and what they choose to do, and that money goes to them. So when you're seeing that driver cam face back, they put stuff on the back of their steering wheels sometimes to where that's what you're seeing when they're driving and everything. But yeah, I do think that there is, you know, how many, where does all the crowds sit on this one? And where are all the cameras positioning? How many turns is this side going to be visible versus this side? There's a science to it, even to the fact where when they're designing this, they have to, when they're choosing paint for liveries and everything like that, they have to take into consideration the weight of the paint and what they want to paint and leave it as exposed, like carbon fiber. For the decals, they have to design those in a way to where they're adding the smallest amount of not only weight to the vehicle, but also because these things are so tested for slipstream and aerodynamics that it's like when we were talking about on Howard Hughes, the way to go faster, he was talking about making flush rivets and making it was like it was flat.
Yeah.
You can't have any type of like drag on these things. So even the science behind where they're putting decals and how they're painting these fucking cars, the technology is fucking crazy.
Yeah, I would assume that they would almost have to lay everything out and then clear coat over the top of it, because even
But then they're like, how much weight do we have for clear coat? Because there is a weight minimum for these vehicles and what they'll try to do.
Well, the whole shooting match, right?
Huh?
Well, the whole car, driver, everything's a whole.
Exactly, yeah. And so that's why you get drivers that'll weigh a little bit more, but they tend to stay around a certain weight. But at the same time, if you come in under this, which you technically want to come quite a ways under it, that gives you the ability, you don't want to stay as light as possible, because then you're going to actually lose traction for weight. There's a perfect balance between power and the weight ratio. They'll actually add ballast to the vehicle's extra weight, but they can strategically, the incentive for that is, let's try to design this, and then we get to put the ballast exactly in positioning on the car where it's going to have the optimum, like, performance.
Yeah, the balancing weight over tires in such a way that everything grips more efficiently. You think they're ever, like, getting ready for a race, and the crew chief walks over and, like, pulls a donut off of his plate, off the driver's plate, and he's like, not today, pal. You got to fit into this car at this weight.
Well, man, what they were talking about, so they weigh the drivers before the race, and they weigh the drivers after the race, because it helps with the calculations. They could do it in the car, but after, you know, the drivers have driven that entire time, their bodies are so fucking beat up from the G's that they got to get out of the car and get the blood flowing, and then they'll just go weigh in individually. But, like, during some of these races, like, I think there's one in Singapore that's known as, like, the hottest one. It's a night race, and it's still so humid and hot that they say these drivers are losing between, like, 7 to 8 pounds during these races.
Yeah, that's sauna-type behavior inside of them. And not to mention, you have to be thinking at all times, because you're making these micro-adjustments.
We'll get into driver performance and how, like, there's an assumption, especially based on sometimes how you see NASCAR drivers and everything, regarding the, like, athletic requirements of the guys that have to do this. I'll touch on that here in just a second. So 68, in addition to sponsorships, which got you some of the coolest looking fucking cars going forward, you also now have, like, wings added for downforce. And during these, some of these wings, once they were put on and positioned correctly, could, when you were driving at speed, would be five times the weight of the car. So there's kind of been this, I don't think it's really an urban legend is the right term for it, but the theory is that, and it's supported by essentially, like, science, they just haven't tried it before and had the opportunity, that you could actually drive at speed, you could drive an F1 car upside down, and the downforce from the wind pushing it to the surface in which it'd be driving on upside down would hold the car in a place and allow it to just drive upside down. They only have to reach 90, the current ones only have to reach 99 miles an hour to equal their weight and downforce that the car weighs. So any faster than that, the weight that it's pushing down to the road is offsetting what gravity would weigh the car as. The only reason they haven't attempted it yet is in order to get the car up to speed, they're so low profile, and that's how they get as much downforce, is so little air gets under them, is that you would have to design a loop that went around, but the angle of the road turning up to get you into that loop, the ground clearance wouldn't be enough because you're going at an angle.
It would just have to be, like, the shallowest incline.
Or you would have to start the car upside down, tethered, get it up to speed, and then have the tethers release. They're going to do it eventually, because this has been going around. Yes, they will. It's not. Here's what it's going to be. It's going to be a Red Bull fucking video. I'll tell you right now what it's going to be. You've seen, like, them driving, like, the Indy cars, like, on dirt roads and shit like that, and having, like, motorcycles jump over and helicopters. They will be the first to drive the car upside down within the next 3 to 5 years.
All right.
I'm going to fucking text your ass.
Yeah, I hope. I would love to see it. I just, the thought of that gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Well, and it, again, this completely changes it around, because now these cars used to have, like, active suspension and shit like that. Because of the downforce, you can't have, like, suspension on it. You have to use solid springs.
It'll just always be collapsed if it's...
And then if they slow down too much and enough air gets under it. Have you ever seen the F1 wrecks where all of a sudden the car just lifts off and goes backwards?
Like a goddamn jet boat.
Something happens underneath it to lift that just enough for the front wing that's holding that gets damaged to where there's not that downforce, and wind gets under it and flips them right over. And those things are weighing... I think the minimum weight for it is, like, 1,000... Oh, I have it here. Hold on a second. 1,753 pounds is the minimum weight, and they're staying as close to that as possible in that sweet spot. So, solid suspension at that point, to where now you're feeling...
That's way less than a normal car, isn't it?
What do you mean?
Weight-wise.
Yeah.
But their footprint, what's their... Do they have, like, a normal...
Much larger, dude.
Really?
Yeah, but at the same time... What's a regular road car made out of? Steel.
Yeah, and all this is carbon fiber.
For the most part, they're mostly made out of carbon fiber, man.
Yeah.
There's some pieces that can't be, there's, they call it the tub, and that's the section where the driver sits. If you've ever seen like bad wrecks, I've always had this thought of like, what if someone came and sheared off the front of the car, like where the guy's legs are out? Cause like you're literally sitting, like if I were to lean back in this recliner anymore and have my feet propped up ahead of me, up above a little bit,
yeah,
that's, they're almost sitting laying in it. The only thing that's propped up is their like back. Their feet are almost directly out in front of them where the pedals are to maintain that ride height. So that tub is like a, that is the only standardized portion that is provided to these constructors and these teams that has to meet requirements because it's for the safety of the driver.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, but, you know, thinking about that, everything else, as much as they can make it, is just fucking strong ass carbon fiber, with the exception of like, you know, engines can be carbon fiber and shit like that. So we get this guy in the 70s named Bernie Eccleston. And Bernie Eccleston,
it's a hell of a name.
I know. Bernie, again, throws this whole thing fucking on its ass when he does a rearrangement for management of the commercial rights for F1 and basically makes it global. He's the guy that has basically, he's credited with turning it into the multi-billion dollar business it is. He basically
takes, like the David Stern that shows up and changes the game.
Yep.
So, not to cut you off, mm-hmm. but just to go back, 1,600 pounds for an F1 car? 1,700 yeah. pounds. By rule, a Sprint Cup car must weigh 3,300 pounds.
Yeah. Because those are aluminum and a lot of, like, maybe
they're just built to go left. Like, they yeah. only need so much in there.
Mm-hmm. And they're not traveling as fast either. Like, that's why if you see, like, an F1 car even go into the wall a little bit, like, you know, when you're watching on TV, it's like the, it's watching professional basketball.
Yeah.
You're looking at somebody and you're like, these are all 6'6 plus guys. But you look at the short guy compared to the tall guy and like, that guy looks like 5'8.
Yeah. Steph Curry looks small. Steph Curry's like 6'3, 6'2. So
when you're picturing in an F1 race, everyone's traveling. You know, the difference between teams in this, which is so nuts, and the spending is, could literally be, you know, some cars get lapped depending on tracks and stuff like that. But between some of the top cars, during qualifying and shit, it's tenths, hundreds of a second, the yeah. speed difference between these yeah, guys
true.
And these teams. So when you're thinking about it from a standpoint of like weight in that sense, those things, when they get in those wrecks, they're traveling so fast, it's like they just shred apart. Like the wings look like, and you're like, that looks weak as fuck. It's like, they're just going that fast and yeah. hitting things at this. So like they bump a wall and the whole wheel gets ripped off. And you're like, it didn't even look like he was going that fast. But they're traveling at just such a speed around each other. It's nuts. Mm-hmm. So what he also does is he basically, prior to Bernie coming in, the guys that owned the circuits where they were racing, these weren't like owned by the FIA. So the circuit owners, kind of like if it was the owner of like MSG, Madison Square Garden.
James Dolan.
Exactly. What they would get to do is they were like, if you want to come play here, this is how much money you're going to make for coming to play here. They controlled all of the income and they negotiated differently with every team. So no one was getting an equal piece of the pie. So more pop, you know, Ferrari's coming in. Fuck yeah. We're giving Ferrari yeah. a shit ton of money. Okay. These smaller teams that were just like, oh, you can race, but we're only going to pay. They weren't making enough money. And so you're getting all this turnover and inconsistency and everything. Teams dropping out. Some years they didn't have a ton to fill. They're having to bring in like Formula 2 teams and stuff. They were able to enter in. And these smaller independent teams able to enter in just to try to fill the field.
I should have asked this question earlier. Formula 1
mm-hmm.
is the minor league form. This feels
Formula
like
Formula 1 is the top. Okay. You're counting up. So Formula 1, number one.
Yeah. This, I didn't ask this question because I thought it was going to be dumb. And then I found myself in a dumb moment. So Formula 2 is the next tier below. Is mm-hmm. there a Formula 3?
Yes.
How far do we go?
Yeah. 2, 3. And then, yeah, 3, I think, is kind of the bottom. And then we'll talk about how it kind of starts out. Under that is like karting.
Okay. And what do you think, as far as like how NASCAR showed up through like bootlegging
mm-hmm.
and that kind of a thing, did F1, was it just like the love of movement?
What kind of like invented it?
Yeah.
It was, I think it was mostly like countries trying to fucking outdo each other and being like, our car's faster. No, our car's faster. It was like fucking country like rivalries.
The space race on asphalt kind of.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. That makes more sense.
Yep. So Bernie also basically is like, you know what? Let's not do this anymore. So he got all of the teams together and he's like, we're all going to negotiate together. And that way, this guy is either going to pay all of us Yeah. And everyone's going to get it. You know, there might have been deviations in the shares, but it was going to be more. It was going to be a lot more fair.
Collective bargaining.
Or this motherfucker's not getting races at his circuit, and he's not going to make any money. So it was like a hunt as a pack mentality, kind of like how like on TV shows, like if the cast is really close together, they'll all go to the bargaining table together and be like, "We all want to make that." Like when Friends and like Modern Family and all that kind of shit, they all went together instead of individuals. Because like if you look at Friends, like Rachel was probably the most popular character. And out of the guys, it might have been like, I don't know who it would have been, like RIP fucking Matthew Perry that just passed away.
Crazy.
But also, what I'm saying is, instead of going as the most popular ones that could get the most money and then everyone else getting less, they wanted to present an equal front. So it that's was what like the Formula One teams
formulated their own union.
Exactly, yeah. So in 77, this company named Renault.
Yep.
So Renault is a huge auto manufacturer. They say it almost might be the largest auto manufacturer in the world. It's French. And it's like also like, I want to say not government, maybe government owned, also partially government owned. So, I mean, it's an auto manufacturer. That's the reason I'm mentioning that is that would be like Ford being partially run by the U.S. government.
Yeah. They make a bunch of small cars. No, I didn't realize they had a racing division.
Yeah.
Do they still?
Well, they've been an engine provider for a long, long time. And that's what's also weird. You'll see these teams still being engine providers for other teams like McLaren for the longest time. You would think McLaren, they make their own cars. They make their own engines. McLaren was provided by their engine by Mercedes for the longest time.
It's almost like they don't have time to do that R&D. So they'll just or sort of funding. Farm it out.
Or the yeah, funding. Okay. Think you could design all of the components of a vehicle and all that kind of stuff. But when it came down to the engine, you could either be like, we're going to probably fuck this up for a good long portion of time trying to design something like this. Or we can go with this one that's already in operation and is built for this. But then the drawback about not being your own engine constructor is that when you get to make that, like, for example, let's say Mercedes, when Mercedes is designing that engine, they're designing it with the intended purpose and performance for the Mercedes setup and how they're going to run their car and their suspension, everything like that. That's what that engine is peaked for. Other companies will get that engine and not have any input in it. They'll just buy those engines from them and then have to shape their car to try to get the most performance out of that. So it could be like, fuck, we don't have our exhaust routed here. Now we got to completely redo the exhaust system, which throws off the aerodynamics. And so there's this huge challenge to these companies that are buying these engines versus constructing them and being able to have them customized. So you get these teams like Renault, who was for a while selling engines to Red Bull. And Red Bull felt like they were getting the short end of it because they didn't have any input on the engine construction. But they had won like the previous like five driver championships or constructors as well. And so that's where you get them going over to Honda when Honda's like, hey, you want to slap our name on that big fucking back wing of yours? You come and tell us what you need for an engine. We have all the infrastructure. We've been making engines for fucking ever. And now you have Red Bull domination right now because they've had that input on how to design it.
So basically, you can either spend like $150 million on R&D to develop an engine, or you can buy one from Mercedes, but it will be tuned in a Mercedes-type way instead of what you would already be building.
It's like buying. It's like having your clubs fitted for you.
Yeah, so like you would have to reverse engineer your vehicle for the engine.
You got to reverse engineer your game for the clubs that you got instead of designing clubs that fit you to your game.
But it comes at a cost of maybe like half of what you would have invested in research and development to build your own.
Correct. And at the same time, what you're really doing too is you're funding this other team because you're paying this money to them and just advancing their research. So in a way, they're increasing their advancement, but then you're maybe getting a sliver of that enhancement because the engine is just better overall.
So is McLaren the only American
They're company? Not American. They're considered a British team.
Really?
Yeah.
McLaren's American.
Nope. It's weird to say because like they are now like owned by an American company. And the way that these like Ferrari is like one of the only, and they're even owned by I think like Fiat or something now.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's just some examples, some factory teams, what they consider factory teams like Ferrari. They design it from fucking soup to nuts from the ground up. Only thing that isn't Ferrari on there, I think, is the Pirelli tires. So Pirelli is the only tires that Formula One is allowed to use. It's been different in the past with Bridgestones and stuff, but Pirelli for the last like decade has been the exclusive provider for tires.
They're the creme de la creme, too.
But
Pirelli
how much
tires are...
They are, but how much of that is because of Formula One? That's why you see them on the creme de la creme of vehicles.
Yeah, well, they had to get there somehow, too.
Mm-hmm. So with like, and I'll get back to the history in a second, but since we're kind of already deep on this. So like also with like constructors and everything, the factories for this, kind of talking about like the team sizes, there's 1,200 people working for the Mercedes F1 team. And the factory that they have, it's not like just, you know, you go to the Mercedes factory where they're bumping out like G-Wagons and shit like that and sedans.
Yeah.
And then like back over in this wing is like, they're like, and here's our Formula One department. No, it's a dedicated factory where they have machines to, sorry, not to say two words in succession, but machines to machine everything that they have. So think of it from like, well, we need these bolts that are going to hold on the suspension. They need to be exactly this size and this weight to meet the weight requirements. Instead of like calling a company and being like, we need to order 500 bolts and having those be of varying qualities and things like that where they have no control, they're building every single component of these vehicles. Everything, the suspension, the bolts that are going in, they're threading aluminum rods down to. So you have all of these custom parts that all of these teams are making, the big teams. Red Bull has, I think, 1,000 employees. And then you get down to the bottom tier where Alfa Romeo has like 300 employees. And Haas, the American F1 team, has 250. And then that's not even to say like what the budgets are between these teams. And it kind of goes the same with like their actual like employment and everything.
Well, and that's essentially it, right? Because Alpha is going to be smaller in the production of vehicles that they churn out,
or
whereas Mercedes is going to be.
And here's the thing is, Alfa Romeo is just like one of the title sponsorships of the Sauber Racing team. So the team is actually Sauber Racing. And Alfa Romeo is like the key primary sponsorship.
Okay.
So there's also, I mean, it's such a fucking like, it's almost like spycraft, not spycraft, but there's so much to it. So teams will have certain levels or certain types of sponsorship they want to be after. You can be like a technical sponsor where you're paying less as far as sponsorship goes, but you're a technology company that they can then use your technology to advance the car because you have divisions that specialize in things that would be of use. One of the first times that that happened was, I think, I can't remember if it was the 70s or 80s, but it was after sponsorship where Williams Racing, which has, I think, the lowest budget now. They used to dominate, I think, back in like the 80s and everything. Williams was insanely dominant.
Yeah.
Their budget's estimated, and it might give or take because the information is hard to come by because it's not super publicly traded or available. Williams, I think their budget is like $66 million versus like $400 million for like Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull, who were like spending $125 to $225 million on engine research and manufacture alone. It's like 50% of a team's budget is the power of the engine. And so you have like, I'm getting sidetracked from this. What was your question?
Oh, my question.
Oh, sorry. I know where I was going with that. My bad. Haas, a smaller team with a smaller budget.
Oh, yeah, okay.
They are almost not really, they're a constructor in that they try to design most of it, but they also get a lot of their pieces that are like prefab pieces from other places. So they're almost trying to, and it's why, you know, traditionally they may not perform as well because they're not researching and building their stuff custom. They're getting parts and pieces that while they're close, they're just not as good as the other ones that are made primarily for those. So you see these teams with smaller budgets trying to do things their own way that aren't quite as successful.
They're like building Franken cars instead.
They're trying to build their way up to place, you know, fourth or fifth in the constructors for like a couple seasons.
Yeah, you don't have to win. You just have to do better. I didn't even really think about that, but it's not necessarily amassing first place finishes if you're looking for the constructors.
You just have to be consistent with both of your vehicles. Yeah. And then once you get to that point, then guess what? You get to make that money that you got as that fifth place constructor. That can all go in to then your R&D department. Maybe you can start manufacturing some more of your parts. Maybe you can order some more machines that can help you in development and everything. Maybe you can hire a race engineer or an aerodynamicist that used to work for McLaren. You can give him money and he's going to come in and help you kind of reshape the car in a way that's going to even bump you up another place. They said it's a science of literally shaving tenths to hundredths of a second off can be the difference between a third place, you know, constructor cup finish and a first place throughout the year.
I don't know why everything European has to be more confusing.
it's just so much more involved. It seems like there's just so many more moving parts to it. So back in 77, we were talking about Renault. Oh, Bingham, that's why we got into it, because of the manufacturer and the constructors and everything. So in 77, Renault pioneers turbocharged engines that were able to produce in these vehicles that were super lightweight, about 700 horsepower. And within 9 years, BMW was like, we're going to get it up to 1300 horsepower. And it didn't take very long. 86 is when they did that. 89, the FAA is like, nope, fuck it. We're banning turbocharged engines. They were going too fast. It was too unsafe. The technology of keeping these things, I think it's much easier to design something that just increases more power than to design the thing that's going to keep that fucking power connected to the road. And then the next year they're like, well, we have 50 more horsepower. They're like, fuck, we're barely keeping this shit on the road.
Yeah. It's like trying to conduct an orchestra because everything, you can't have like a horn section that's blowing like a motherfucker because everything
they're sliding else is in synthesizers and then they slide in a full drum kit and you're trying to conduct the orchestra while they're sliding in advanced or like higher tech instruments and everything. You're like, I don't know how to fucking work with this.
Yeah. Everything has to be in concert for these things to just not kill whoever's driving them.
So, and it's kind of cool to see, and I can get the whole, you know, if you're already an F1 fan and you're listening to this, and, you know, I apologize for any inaccuracies in the information, but I think where you get, you know, the fun, the drawback and the pros and cons of F1 is you'll get these eras where these teams are just wholly dominant because they cracked the code. They figured out that one little thing, and then every other team, because it's a secret, they're trying to catch up and crack that code too. So you get these eras and these decades where certain teams are just dominant, but then all of a sudden, like we're seeing with the dominance that Mercedes had had 2 years back, winning, I think, 8 Constructors' Cups or Constructors' Championships, and then moving into this advancement of Red Bull, not only is the technology advancing, but you also have these FIA regulations that are always coming up. They'll be like, hey, the new rules are going to be implemented 2 years from now. So, like, you have this balance of these teams being like, well, fuck, do we start using this money to develop into the new regulations and just sacrifice the current season and hope that other teams are doing the same thing and we end up losing this season because we're funneling money over here? Or do we do the same thing, pool our money here, and then hope that we can advance in that year that it's going to take us? And so the whole thing with, like, Mercedes and Red Bull is during this development period, Red Bull was just better developing this new car that was going to meet the new regulations and restrictions. And it's cool to see the deviations. Like, you look at an Indy car a Formula One car screaming down the track, you see it in the pit, and they're, you know, they all kind of have the same shape because they have to be a ride height, length, width. Yeah. The wings are kind of, you know, there's a formula that if someone figured out the best way to capture aerodynamics for the rear wing, everyone's looking at that. These teams have photographers whose job it is just to go around and take pictures of the other team's cars that they can get to. It's just this constant, like, spy craft type thing too. And so,
like, the goddamn University of Michigan over there stealing signs.
Exactly. And so you get to, like, certain levels of peak performance with these types of things. And then the big thing a few years ago was there was a talk of side pods. Look at all the different side pods. And basically when you're looking at a Formula One car, you know how jets have that scoop, like the F-16 and stuff like that. You know, the F1 vehicles have scoops on their sides that are supposed to direct air in to cool the engine, but at the same time, not too much air, but deflect other air around it. And you have teams trying to design the best way to do that. So you have different shapes. Some are wider than others, but, like, the bottom of the car is the same width because they have to meet those requirements. And Red Bull just designed this perfect, their design engineer is this world-renowned guy. And basically through wind tunnel testing and all this kind of crazy stuff, designed, you know, the Mercedes Slayer. And that's why, you know, plus a good driver and everything, a couple of good drivers have really kind of turned that in their fortune. But back in, I think it was like the 80s and 90s, McLaren and Williams were those teams just dominating. And it's crazy to see that you have, even as we say the 90s isn't that long ago, but again, 20, 25 years ago, you have a team that was completely dominant. And now they're last place, what they call on the grid. So the, you know, where they line up to start and everything like that. But they also refer to that as their placement in the constructors and their rankings, that are on the bottom of the grid and are basically fighting for survival, because you have so much money being poured into these other larger teams now that they just can't keep up.
So what is the order of start? Is that based on constructors rankings or drivers rankings?
Nope, it's qualifying every single week.
Okay, so they still do qualifying too.
Yeah, I'll get
so like when you say the spot on the back of the grid.
You know, what I mean by that is they say the back of the grid. That's both referring to who's at the back of the starting line, but also who's at the back. You know, if like Williams is usually always at the back of the grid, and what they refer to is because during qualifying, their cars aren't fast enough to qualify to be up at the front of the grid.
Oh, so it sort of shows out the rankings as far. Okay.
Exactly. You can, it's a visual, almost like if you look at the starting grid or the finishing grid, if you're looking at the top 10, you're like, makes sense. Sometimes you'll get like a smaller driver that got up into there because
surprise,
he made a good tire decision and went on a different type of tire that gave him more grip. There was a wreck that allowed him to advance up three positions and everything. But for the most part, you see some consistency in that top four, three or four core. They call it, I want to say, the top three or four. And then you have what is the best of the rest or the midfield. And so when you place fourth or fifth, they call that we're the best of the rest. Because it's been so dominated by Ferrari, Mercedes, Red Bull, that, you know, you have teams even like McLaren that you would think like these guys have been around forever. They're a top tier team fighting to get like fourth in the Constructors Cup and then waiting for their turn to maybe crack that code in the factory that allows them to take that next step when they figure out something nobody else has.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but just to equate it to like American sports, it's sort of like you can go all in and trade all your draft picks to try to win now.
I think baseball is the best way to think about it when you're thinking about the Yankees and the Sox compared to the Oakland Athletics.
But even teams like Mercedes that have insane budgets for these things, they can still take a backseat and have to rebuild because they go all in on trying to win with their current technology.
Because you're only allowed, like, you know, you can do testing, but they're for testing and everything like that, teams are limited to time they can do off-season testing. They're limited to times that they can spend using wind tunnels.
Yeah.
Even if they're their own wind tunnels in their factories, all of that has to be cataloged and monitored electronically to where the FAA can come in and be like, nope, you use too much. You're going to get a penalty this year for this many points. There was some controversy about Red Bull overspending on the allocated budget. They have caps now, kind of. They've started to try to close the field and close the gap. Red Bull went over literally like like $500,000. And when you're thinking about that, you're like, well, in comparison to, you know, it isn't. But what if that $500,000 went into development of a side pod that was what cracked the code versus what they said it was? It was a catering oversight. And so you're like, $500,000, like, that's a lot of fucking steak.
It's a lot of catering.
But it's, you can't question it because when you realize the scope of like the employees for like some of these companies, not only who's back at the factory working all this, this thing is literally a traveling circus for the season. That's why they also have during the Formula One season, they'll have these like week, like 2-3 week month long breaks, because the way that the tracks are set up, they're traveling, you know, over to the United States, then down to South America. A lot of the stuff is still kind of in Europe and everything, but you're traveling to Abu Dhabi, you're traveling over to Sochi on the other side of Russia, China, Japan.
The streets of Chicago, wasn't it? Did they just have a street race in Chicago?
They did. There's one in Austin. I don't know about Chicago. There's been places in the United States that have got races that don't have them anymore. The main one for the last few years has been the Circuit of the Americas at COTA, I think, which is in Austin. So that's been the main one for the United States when they first kind of came back to do a race here. Last year they did Miami, or the year before they did Miami, where they were racing around the fucking Hard Rock Stadium and everything. So they designed the courses in part of the parking lot, on part of the city streets of Miami, around the stadium and everything. It's fucking nuts what goes into this too, to design these. It's like there's companies that will specifically be hired to go and map out an image and like, where can we do this race? How many corners should we have? What degree of corner? And they have to try to fit this around like a city.
Well, isn't that what, doesn't Monaco like go through the streets?
So Monaco, I think, is what's, it's the crown jewel of the F1 season and everything. That is like the same route that they were racing back in like the 30s and 40s when they were doing the Monaco Grand Prix. And that's why like in Monaco, it's super dangerous, super tight. And there are certain races, you know, pole position or your position on the grid to start with for qualifying is always important because not only for the fact of placement and getting off the line. Sorry, I got a tickle in my throat. But in Monaco, where it's, you know, tight turns, not a lot of like straights where it's wide, overtaking is insanely hard. You have to try to like catch someone in the pits or catch someone off guard, or someone has to wreck, and then you have to get around them. So like qualifying there is king. The chances of you winning if you don't qualify in pole position go down more dramatically than in any other circuit. And then you have other circuits where maybe you don't want pole position. There's a couple circuits where there's a straightaway leading into a first turn where if you are actually second or third, you get more speed coming out of that turn and able to beat the first place person into the second turn.
You almost want to build in a reason to pass somebody. Or like if you see something that you can be competitively more advantageous at. So that way...
Dude, the study that these guys do, like, it's not just like, hey, we're going to go walk the track and kind of see everything. These guys, when they're not in the cars, they're on simulators, literally training for these courses, going through them for, you know, how many seconds. There's racers that are like, I can close my eyes and run this circuit just based upon how I know the seconds of when I have to turn the wheel to this degree or this degree. So these guys are constantly training to know these courses inside and out, to know where this line is going to be. Not only that, but when you're thinking about like a racing line, you're like, well, this is the fastest way to get in and out of this corner. I go wide on this, I hit the apex, and then I come out of it. At the same time, you're also thinking, is everyone else hitting this? And once it gets to a certain point in the race, there's going to be enough rubber laid down on this section where I can go through this section at more speed because I know there's going to be more grip. So the amount of just like study that has to go into these things for these drivers, like you were saying, you just kind of look at when the race happened, you're like, these guys are just driving these cars. But when you look at what has to happen for them to have the ability to react in these seconds and get the tires close to the, have you seen some of the highlights of where it shows the tires going past like the walls in Monaco?
I've seen Monaco a couple times. Like you're talking about the buildings and shit.
Yeah. But like they'll come around a guardrail and like the outside of the Pirelli will actually like touch the guardrail and just shift the car ever so slightly.
Oh,
but they're doing that every lap.
Even when you see like the amount of space between like the blockers that are on the side of the road, like I think they're like red or white, almost like trapezoidal things that come up on turns.
Yeah,
you
just
can
like the
see
little...
that, like you can almost fit a fucking piece of construction paper in between,
or you'll see the car
rail.
Just go airborne for just this, and then all of a sudden you'll see that downforce kick in and it'll just hug right to the track again.
I think the most impressive thing so far that you've said is just how these guys are so machine-like that you can put them out for a practice lap, whatever, a time trial to figure out their positioning. And the fact that they're so categorically good at what they do that based on how they've lined up in this constructor's cup rankings or whatever, that they can then repeat that in these trials to find those spots. Like to be able to be that automatic that you can do something for so long during the season to get you into a spot. And then you just know if you've built yourself into third, you'll just start third every time on a pole lap.
Well, and it's not only that, it's the simple fact that like there's even a science to like the qualifying. So like when they go out, I'll just kind of touch on tires too. I won't spend too much time on it, but so you have like different types of tires that you can use. So you have basically like the full on slicks that you would normally see that they first start out on. And those come in both like hard, intermediate, and soft based upon the composition of like the components in the tire. So you get a soft tire that's going to heat up faster. That heat is going to transfer to traction on the road and you're going to be able to take those corners much faster. However, because of that, you are going faster, but because of a softer composition and them heating up faster, the tires degrade.
Yeah, you're going to burn through them quicker.
Yep. Then you have your hards, which are going to last you longer. They're going to take longer to heat up. They're going to give you less traction, but you're going to be able to go longer. And so during these races, they're required to use at least two different types of tires. So then you have this strategy, and this kind of translates back over to qualifying. Qualifying, you have a time period in which to get in your fastest lap. So what you'll do is you'll get out there and you'll run the car around kind of medium, warm up the tires and everything. And then you'll have your lap where you actually attempt to go for your time at an optimum point where your soft tires that you're able to use, because you don't have to worry about your tires burning out within that 15 minutes. You're heating them up to the optimum temperature to where you can then attempt your fastest lap to try to set that. And so not only are you going around this trying to not crash during your first laps, then all of a sudden you're just flooring it and going all out to set this fastest time.
That's the amount of balls you have to have to be able to just.
I'll get into some of the speed and the facts and kind of what these guys go through when we talk about how like they're training and everything. Just kind of to round out kind of the history to go back to it. There was a time when there's the big four, and it's McLaren, Williams, Renault, and Ferrari that were taking place back in like the 80s, 90s, and kind of the early 2000s. And drivers from the big four won every world driver championship from 1984 to 2008. So only those four teams won in the span of 24 years.
16, 39 years?
Well, no, from 84 to 2008.
Oh, 2008.
Yeah.
So 16,
like, can you think about that? If there were only, and we get like spells in like football and shit like that, but like only four teams ever won the Super Bowl for fucking 24 years.
Yeah, it's sort of more of a quarterback thing now because I think there's only like three quarterbacks that are active that have won. Like,
yeah, you just have to maintain crazy consistency. And then the Constructors was even crazier because those guys won the Constructors from 79 to 2008. So 29 years. And then you'd have someone snuck in from a smaller team to steal that driver's championship there for those 5 years.
Yeah,
up to 84.
You don't have to be the best. You just have to be the most consistently at the top.
So kind of talking about like the advancement of going through history and everything. So then we get to what's called the hybrid era. So the hybrid era, that's when Mercedes comes in and dominates. And they had seven driver championships and eight constructors up till 2 years ago. And that's when Lewis Hamilton came in. But you know, are also getting into a situation where I think technology is advancing between the larger teams that I don't know if that kind of dominance is really going to go forward anymore. Because it's become so popular now that you have all these people pouring in investment. Do you know Ryan Reynolds bought into one of the teams and has a stake in one of the teams, Alpine?
Is Alpine in Wales?
I'm not sure where Alpine technically is. It used to be like this Wrexham team called Race Force India was owned by this Indian guy who had to end up having the team taken away due to some like dodgy government shit or tax evasion shit. Really? I'm telling you, dude, it's like a fucking soap opera, some of this shit. And then they got new, like, funding and investment, renamed, rebranded. That's kind of how it fucking works. But, yeah, I mean, it's crazy where the domination came from. The hybrid era also brought in, you know, the technology in these cars is so insane that they're now a combination of both, like, an internal combustion engine and electrical engines. And that's how you're able to get more power out of the car while still maintaining certain horsepower and engine size. So these cars will have electric engines that they can tap into for additional power for passing, things like that. And then when they're not using them, they can use, I don't know, understand the technology, but there are ways that they can then recapture that energy into those electric engines to then use later on in the race.
Yeah, it's just got to be revolutions of the tires spinning some sort.
Exactly, and where it's pulling additional power from. But you have, you know, these guys, when they start racing, if you've ever seen the actual, when it shows the actual steering wheel, think of going from like the steering wheels where they were circular, like back in the old ones. And now you have basically these steering wheels that only have the two side holds. And they're like, well, why do they do that? Like, because first of all, the steering wheel has to come off.
Yeah.
Because the driver can't even get in there because they're hugged so tight. And then once the steering wheel goes on, the cars actually can't rotate their wheels past a certain degree. So where a car, I think, can go two or three times all the way around.
Yeah, you're just going either left or right. It's like cruising USA or whatever.
Yeah, you only can bring it, like, you can get it to where your arms are almost crossed over. And, like, you're using that to get out of, like, the garage when the turns aren't longer and everything.
Yeah.
The only reason the team turns in these races kind of seem like they might be sharp turns, it's because these cars are going around them so fast.
If you're going 200 miles an hour, everything's going to be a sharp turn.
Yeah, exactly. So you have also on the steering wheel, you now have so much other stuff that's being controlled on the fly by the drivers. So you know, if you're listening to audio from these Formula One races and it's like mode push, or try setup left, you know, setup three, these guys can change on the fly brake tension depending on what the tires are looking like. They have dials on it. They can adjust all of these things, but then you also have to have the wherewithal to remember what settings you're on if you were just in a different situation a lap previous. like there was a situation where I think it was during the season when it was the big race between contest between Hamilton and Verstappen. And there was Verstappen like went out of the race and Lewis Hamilton was up into like second. And he had been trying to warm up when they had the safety car out. He'd been trying to transfer heat to his front tires to warm them up faster. So he turned up the braking in the front to where the brakes would heat up and by turn heat the tires up. And when they came to the restart, he forgot to reset that back down to his race settings. And when he went to give the amount of force that he was used to giving at this race setting, it locked up the front because they were tighter and he ended up skidding off and being out of the race.
Hmm.
They said there's something in the neighborhood of, I think, like 25 controls on the F1 steering wheel. Controlling the radio, they have a little heads-up display on it that like conveys lap time.
When you say radio, you mean back to the pit crew.
Back to the guys on the pit wall. So okay. F1 drivers are only able to speak to like one guy. They have a race technician who basically that guy is sitting usually next to who's called the team principal. He's like the guy overseeing everything. Then you have like the technical guy who's overseeing the car design, all that kind of stuff. Team principal's in charge of all of them. So he'll usually, like for Mercedes, it's Toto Wolff. For Red Bull, it's Christian Horner. Gunther Steiner for, I think, Haas. You get to know the principals, and I think they're even better than the drivers in this because they're just fucking mind games with each other.
They're all weird dudes.
Huh?
They all seem like they're weird dudes. Verstappen's guy's very weird.
His what?
His principal.
Oh, Christian Horner?
Yeah.
Yeah, you see them, like, and how, like, conniving and backstabbing it is where, like, they'll walk by, and because they lost the race, they'll submit appeals about, like, did you guys check this portion of their car? And there's been situations where they're like, we don't think this part is legal. They'll make them disassemble the car and then reassemble it just to make sure this is fitting, like off of certain like hints dropped by other teams.
I think I heard an interview with Horner about he has a special porta potty in the lineup of porta potties that he has to hit before every race.
It wouldn't surprise me, man. And like,
he's that superstitious about the race that he has to hit the same honey hole every single time.
Yeah, but that's who you'll usually hear if you're hearing stuff inside the car. You'll hear one guy, and they're like always super calm. He's like, the engine just counted. He's like, okay, we'll check into it.
Yeah, it's like a 911 dispatcher.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. And he's like, and okay, we'll look into why the brakes are overheating. And this guy's out on the course, like trying to fucking deal with his own. And he's like, have you tried to cool the brakes?
Yeah.
Back off from the car in front of you. Let's try to cool the brakes a little bit. He's like, fuck, okay. But, you know, you get, yeah, it's crazy. These different, like the hierarchy within these teams and everything. I'm losing track of all this shit.
I think we're caught up to the 90s. You were talking about
the hybrid engines and everything like that.
Yeah, the hybrid.
So that's kind of where we're at now. I mean, technology is advancing fucking crazy in this sport. I heard an interview with a person that was in charge of the livery that designs it for McLaren. And they were talking about how since they're partnered with Google and Chrome, that Google and Chrome have devised, you know, like at sporting events or now at like a lot of like European football matches, they have all of the advertising boards, but they're digital and they change different advertisements.
Yeah.
They've designed those to go onto a Formula One car that it's small enough weight to where they can change the advertisement on the side of it, depending on the lap or whatever they want to do.
I wonder if they're going to turn to the NBA model of what the NBA has done. I don't know how you could do it with motion capturing cameras enough. But if you look at an NBA court now during a game, you'll see certain advertisements on the court. And they even, like the World Series or that's going on, but on the back of the mound, there will be like what looks like a chalk outline of an advertisement.
Yeah.
And that's just digitally imposed on the mound. It's not actually there. And like in the NBA, they will digitally impose different brands on the floors.
So I don't know if you could. I don't know how you'd travel with a car.
That's what I mean. I think that's more of a camera issue.
I was going to say, I think it's a stationary object type deal. But yeah, I mean, it and nowadays and everything like that, just from where it's gone as far as just the number of races. So like in 1950, there were 7 races. Early decades had no more than 11 races a year. Late 70s, they bumped it up to 16 to 17. And 2021 to 22, 22 races. They've added more even this year because they're adding fucking Vegas. That's fucking nuts, man. They're going to be screaming. They're going to be screaming down the straight, down the fucking strip at 200 miles an hour plus.
That's like the epitome of Vegas.
But I think that, I don't know if aside from Monaco, that once they do it in Vegas and if they pull it off and it turns out well, that is going to be the race. Like, think of that, like the glitz, the fucking lights, just everything. That those two seem like it's like a long time coming. Like those two seem like they should just go together. And they should have been going together for years.
I don't know why I got this Chicago Street Race in my head, but oh, never mind. It was NASCAR.
Oh, it was?
NASCAR did it through the streets of Chicago. Okay. So probably trying to suck off the sweet, sweet teat of F1
yes.
a little bit.
So kind of going back to Monte Carlo, I forgot to mention this to you. So in case you were curious, yes, two drivers have driven off the course and wrecked into the harbor, into the water. It was Alberto Ascari and Paul Hawkins. So I just thought that was funny because you always think when they're driving by the water and everything, like all it has to do is flip over this at a certain speed and it's in the drink.
But just like skipping rocks across water, how far did they go out before they sunk?
I don't know.
You would think that they would just glide across the surface for a while.
No. But what if they're like going end over end? Like they hit the barrier. Because there was a barrier.
Then.
But if they hit a barrier and then just went over that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's fucking nuts. Like the speed these modern ones go. So in corners, it's 3.5 Gs, just cornering.
So 3.5 times the weight of gravity?
Yes.
Is that what a G is?
When you're turning. So if you're 150 pounds, your body feels like, what would it be, 500?
3.5, yeah, it'd be about 500.
500 pounds.
Jesus
So Christ. Like going to kind of touching on these guys being athletes and everything, most of these drivers nowadays usually come up from like karting. And not all of them and everything, but it seems like it's more of a common place to go to.
Yeah.
So karting over like in, you know, Europe and everything like that is huge. And I think kids get started somewhere in the neighborhood of like 7 or 8 years old before they actually start. Yeah. Drivers begin karting around 7 or 8. And once they're, you know, it takes money, of course, because this karting isn't usually just local either. Like, this karting will be kind of like all over Europe because you have these guys that are in F1 and a lot of them now you have this weird old guard of guys that are like in their 30s that are like old considered by F1 standards. And you have this like young group of kids coming in and you're just like, how fucking young are these kids? Like Verstappen came in, I think at like 18 years old. Oh, 17 years old is when he had his debut.
Where did he start his karting though? Because isn't he from Perth?
No, that's Daniel Ricciardo.
Oh, okay.
So Daniel Ricciardo started karting, and then when he was like 13 or 14, he had been scouted because they, before a lot of these Formula One races, they would do karting exhibitions and everything. So you have scouts from Formula One and these teams paying attention. So they brought, like at 13 or 14, maybe 15, Daniel Ricciardo left Australia and went to go live in Europe, sponsored by a team to kart to try to develop him.
Huh.
It's a crazy farm system, the way it starts so young and everything. And then you have kids that started karting that came from money. And then you have kids that, like, their parents were working, like, two additional jobs just to keep them in this and everything. So it gives you a backstory of, like, these guys aren't all just, like, fucking, like, rich kids. Like, it was, like, for World War II pilot, like, some early on where you didn't come from affluence. And you get these kids that, like, came from nothing. But you also get these kids from completely different countries that it'll flash back to pictures and be like, oh yeah, we race karts against each other. And it shows them at like 13 years old, like on the podium, like three of the guys that are currently in F1 right now as like 12-year-old kids. And you get these guys coming in that are being trusted with like these multi-million dollar vehicles and you see them put it into the wall and it gets destroyed. And you can just like think back to like the factory of all these guys making hand parts and all that kind of stuff. You watch this and all the guys in the garage and the mechanics, you can just see them being like, fuck,
burning millions of dollars out.
Not
there.
Only that, but you don't just get to roll another car into the garage and do that. You have to take that chassis and that power unit because you're only allocated a certain number of gearboxes and a certain number of engines throughout the year. You get 4 engines per season. And if you take another engine per season because you've blown it out or got totaled in a wreck and it's irreparable, you have to drop like 10 places back in starting position on the next race.
So 4 engines per 2 cars or 4 engines per car?
I think per each one. So 8 per team.
Okay.
And then you get 1 gearbox per 6 events. 1 fucking transmission. And you think that thing is screaming because they're flying through, I think it's like 6 to 8 gears just constantly. So you got to hope that the gearbox doesn't fucking give out.
Yeah.
and you're just running it at its max the entire time. So, I mean, they're going up to, in some of these straights, like 250 miles an hour. And these guys, it shows them training and everything. They're like, so, you know, think of like when I was going around, I was getting on the freeway, and I was going around with the loops that takes you.
Yeah.
And you notice when you get up to a certain speed in like a car with like a loose seat, you start to slide over, and it doesn't take much speed. You're going around like 45 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. These seats are custom molded. They will mold the seats to the drivers to hold them so snugly. And then the only thing that really moves is their arms. And I think the ability to rotate their shoulders, but not move side to side. Cause can you imagine like, if you're trying to, you're leaning to the side, you're pulling on the...
Oh, I would want to be locked in tighter than anything.
You would have, the only thing that can move in those situations while you're harnessed in is like your arms. So you're weighing 500, if you're 150 pounds, 500 pounds going into a turn, and you're doing that how many times per lap for how many laps? So, and then also the G's on the straightaway when you're accelerating and braking all that stuff, their necks, they said, are like, if you look at F1 drivers, their necks are just like weirdly abnormally proportioned to their bodies because they have to do so many neck exercises to keep the helmet up. And not only that, you have to be strong because any deviation in your head takes your eyes off certain things for your reaction times.
I imagine compression on their spine and everything would just be absolutely ruined.
Yeah, well, especially because it's stiff suspension. So bumps, if the car is not performing correctly, they had an issue with the Mercedes last year. They called it porpoising. And they didn't get the airflow going over the car correctly the way they designed it. And in certain straights, the back end would bounce. And if you're bouncing, going that fast and everything, it was just compressing them. Like, the drivers were having back issues.
Yeah, I'd imagine that's probably why 30 is considered old for Formula One, because your body just takes such a toll. It's like the opposite of being in space.
Not only that, but just from a metabolic standpoint, like... the nutrition these guys have is fucking crazy. They have certain things, you know, that they're supposed to eat and hydrate up to a certain level and tricks to do all this, because from a mental processing peak, you have to peak mentally at this exact time for this exact race and then do the same thing every week. So your body has to be in peak condition, not only to withstand the punishment it's taking, but to also keep your brain operating as optimally as it can be.
And if you have to pee during the race,
you piss in your car, dude.
Just get out.
They said the seats have no ventilation, so when it's raining on the wet races, they'll fill with water, their seat buckets, and then you'll fill it with other stuff if you have to.
Shit.
It's pretty fucking nuts, man. Not only just specific to the drivers, but you watch like a NASCAR pit stop. It pulls in, zoom, 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 zoom. They're popping all the lugs off the tire. The guy's out there with the fucking jacks and the gas refilling and everything like that. I didn't look at it exactly. I think they said the NASCAR ones are somewhere around like 8 or 9 seconds, which is insane considering what they're doing and everything. Pit stops in Formula One, before 2010, they used to actually refuel the cars and be able to manage how much fuel due to weight and everything. They stopped doing that due to cost and safety reasons. Because everything is happening so fast in there. I'm assuming they may have had some fire issues. I think I've seen a couple.
Yeah.
And they stopped doing that. So the cars carry the gas for the full load, which that also adds like another element of the danger that, like, if you wreck within the first couple laps and it's a big wreck, you've got a full fucking tank of gas.
You're burning a lot of fuel in that fire.
Yeah. And now pit stops are down to 2 to 3 seconds is about the average pit stop to change the four tires. From the time the thing stops in the pit stops, gets jacked up the tires, and the time the car is going. This year, McLaren set the record for a 1.8-second pit stop. It literally went zip, 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 and the car was gone.
Yeah, so according to the Google machine, 3 times faster than a NASCAR pit crew.
Yeah. On average, not just that stop. That stop would have been 4 times faster or even more.
You can't even... 1.8 is... hard to fathom.
Yeah. And I mean, it helps that like their wheels are held on by one singular lug. So it's just a guy pulling off, throwing it off. Okay. And then it's so fucking fluid. But those guys, all these teams now have training departments for these crews full time in which they're working out, their nutrition is managed, and they're constantly drilling because even that extra 0.5 seconds to get you out of the pit, to get you in front of another car to slow someone down, that's life or death to these top tier teams. It's pretty just fucking nuts what they go through overall.
If you fall, you probably get fired, right?
There was, on Drive Survive, there was a guy, I don't know if it was two separate guys. They were doing a double stop, and it's crazy because what they'll do is they'll stop the car one right after another in the same pit. So they're literally moving eight tires out, eight tires in, and they're able to do it. Zip, zip, and then the other car's pulling in immediate, not even putting on the brakes till it gets into the spot. And one guy, I don't know if it was one or two guys, but during the same stop or one right after another, the lug didn't get tightened down on the car on one car. Next stop came in, lug didn't get tight, and they had to retire. It was the Haas team. They had to retire both cars within, I think, a lap of each other. And we're out of points for the race. And for those smaller teams, not having the opportunity to score even any points.
It's a death sentence.
Is a death sentence for funding. It's fucking crazy. It didn't show the guy getting fired. I mean, you could tell by the look on his face that it was definitely the first thing on his mind, how he was reacting and everything. But, I mean, I don't know if that's just, you know, a byproduct of the business. That's going to happen every now and then. You'll see them where they get stuck in the pits. It'll shred the lug. The air wrench will shred it, and they can't get the tire off, and the car just has to get retired.
Yeah, that's for as scary as it would be being a driver with life or death on the line to be one of those pit stop guys and have like an inch on your nose and you're not ready to jump in there and knock it out fast.
You grab the wrong tire.
Yeah.
I mean, and they do. I mean, they've, you know, as the cars have gotten faster and everything's gotten ramped up and everything, they've had to do some safety implementations. Like if you've noticed on old classic Formula One cars, there's nothing, you know, over the driver. It's just the cockpit and everything. I guess I don't know what the situation they called for it, but they did some testing on this thing called the Halo device. And that's now what you see on it, where it's the bar that comes kind of right. It's the skinny one that comes right up the middle between their eye line, and it's super skinny so they can see. And then the loop that goes around their heads.
Yeah.
So probably that was to tested. Keep
them from.
No, what it is for is it's to prevent large objects during a wreck from getting in. And because if you're, think of it, if you're like, I was trying to picture what could have brought this about. You're in a wreck and that car in front of you lifts off at all and starts coming up from the front of your car. There's nothing to stop it between crushing your, I mean, you're sitting low, but if it's taken off a layer of your car, it could crush your head against whatever's behind you.
Yeah.
So this thing is supposed to be able to support the weight, I think, of another car or even more than that, this Halo device. And there's even been situations where cars have flipped upside down and you can see the Halo being the thing that's keeping the driver's head off it and just sparking as it goes. There was a couple incidents that come to mind that I've seen recently, and Drive Survive has an episode that's dedicated to one of them. The first one before that is Hamilton and Verstappen were kind of in a fight. Hamilton was ahead of him. Verstappen tried to get ahead of him and bounced over a curb and launched his car up and over, grinding over the top of Hamilton's. The back of it then ended up on the front of Hamilton's. But when they went to do the replay, the tire came over and hit Hamilton's head. And the only reason it didn't go further in and mash his head down into him was because it touched the Halo. There were tire marks on his helmet. And it's fucking nuts. The biggest one that, like, if you have, you need any reason to believe this thing should be in existence. This guy, Romain Grosjean, was a driver for Haas. And it was during, I think it might have been somewhere in the Middle East. And he lost control of the car. And you know those barriers that are along like a freeway? We have them in the States. I don't know what your guys' barrier situation is overseas and everything. But they're the metal ones that are up on like the 4x4s, the AB8s. And the actual metal barrier sits about, I don't know, like a foot and a half off the ground. They had that at part of this track. The car shot underneath it and was able to go under it. When it got to a certain point behind the driver, it had gone over the Halo and kept him from getting fucking decapitated. And then it ripped off the back end of the car and just the front end just was trapped under this thing and burst into flames. And I don't know how long, because, you know, of course, on TV, they're going to show it scene after scene from different angles. And you know how long it is. A full like fucking inferno engulfed this. You couldn't even see the driver. Safety crew was out there trying to use the fire extinguishers and everything. And then in between the flames where the camera could see, you could see the driver's head moving around and he was trying to move. And it was like underneath the fucking rail that he'd went under. He fucking ends up getting out and had burns on his hands and on his feet, but he was able to fucking get out of that.
Huh?
And they were just like, the Halo's not in existence. He's dead automatically.
He wouldn't have lived to see the fire.
No, exactly. He would have been dead before that. But you know, even in spite of that, you see some of these wrecks and you're like, how the fuck are these guys walking away? The car shreds, goes upside down. Some when they're traveling on straights and they go off like in the rain and shit like that, the way they're hitting these walls, they said that they're hitting them at like 30, 40 Gs. The impact it makes when they hit those tires on the outside, it's just fucking nuts.
Yeah, it's too much. It's just pushing like the limits of anything a human can sustain.
But I mean, the guys that are able to do this, you know, at the top tier are making fucking insane money on par with any of the biggest athletes in the world.
That's a trade-off, though, is it if is. You can survive it, you will be handsomely rewarded.
You're like this weird mix of like a fucking rock star and a fucking daredevil. Like, you're doing this thing that's like death-defying. I mean, they've really ramped down on the deaths. I think the last Formula One driver that died, didn't look into injuries, but died, was this guy named Jules Bianchi. And there was a wreck that had happened around this corner. It was raining, and they'd already got like the tractor that comes and lifts the car up and moves it off. And he came around the corner and slipped and went into the back of the tractor.
Shit.
He survived for, I think, 9 months, but then due to complications of it, I think that's when he passed. So they've implemented like changes as often as they can. But the fact that some of these guys, when you see some of these wrecks and cars launching over it and everything, and then guys are just like pop, pop and hopping out. It's fucking bonkers, man. I can't stress enough watching that just for something to fucking entertain you.
Yeah, it's a world that I really don't understand. And just the sheer amount of money that goes into it. That was another thing I was going to ask you. I don't know if you have like a hard explanation of the cap, the salary cap,
basically. Of what the numbers are at? I don't know what it is exactly. I know it's been brought down, so it'll...
Well, what was the implementation was just to try to even the playing field? Yes. Or...
Yep. So spending was just because you have these teams that like Mercedes and, you know, I like Lewis Hamilton and everything. I'm a Lewis Hamilton fan, but I've also seen drivers with like smaller teams like Bottas is awesome. I wish he was in a faster car. You can't not love Daniel Ricciardo. He's fucking awesome. And he has driven for several teams and everything. And now he's getting a chance to drive again, I think, for Toro Rosso, which is like a Red Bull junior team within Formula One. He's getting a chance again. But the guys that, you know, at a glance that you would look at, they're like, you know, I don't know a lot about Michael Schumacher. I know he was so dominant in this sport for the longest time. And his record was only tied, I think, by Lewis Hamilton for driver championships. But they have the most, I think, at 7. I don't know a lot about him, but you just like look at him as a racer. And until you know something about him, if you just see they're a dominant, awesome racer, you're like, that guy's probably pretty fucking cool. But then you find guys that aren't dominant racers. You're like, I'm rooting for this fucking underdog.
Yeah,
I'm rooting for this guy.
Something about him.
Yeah. But like just kind of going back to like cost and even for these drivers, I think Verstappen is currently making $55 million a year for Red Bull. And that's not counting. That's his base salary. That's not counting what bonuses he gets for placement in the driver championship.
And sponsorship probably.
Mm-hmm. Hamilton, I think, is making 35. He just signed another contract with Mercedes through, I think, 2016. But I'm not sure what the figures are. I'm assuming it's quite a bit. Again, this stuff is before these guys' sponsorship. And if you ever want to pick up your Ladies Vogue or any type of magazine that has some type of international following or publication, you'll go through and, you know, tag Heuer and all these fucking just insane brands. And you'll be like, who the fuck is this guy? And it'll be one of a fucking Formula One driver wearing a fucking watch or a Rolex or some shit. So these guys are, you know, it hasn't made its way. It's growing in the States, especially with Austin and Miami and now Vegas becoming a thing. It's growing, but, you know, these guys are far from, you know, the most popular sport or athletes in the United States. And because we have so much to choose from. I think that's also why it's been kind of kept at bay in the U.S. because we have a lot of options. We already have automotive racing. We have IndyCar racing, which some people look at and like, that's just Formula One for the United States. Completely different. They're open wheel. But as far as that goes, they're starting off like everyone's kind of level. You get a choice of three motors that you can use, two or three motors you can use. All the chassis are like uniform standard. And so it's just about what you can do within a lot less options. It's less speed, everything like that. But there's been guys that have come from Formula One, then dominated Indy, then gone into like Le Mans and everything. And I think, I'm trying to remember who it was that did that. Oh, Mario Andretti.
Yep.
That's his big thing, is he's like the king of motorsports because he's branched out to so many of these other ones.
I think Elio Castroneves had a little time split in between.
Oh, I'm sure there's plenty of drivers that have actually done that or do other types of motor racing, Baja, things like that. I think if you have that desire to, I want to go fast, then you're looking for a fucking every way you can go about it.
You're probably just looking to feed that addiction behind any sort of steering wheel.
But I mean, it's just the nuts and bolts of it are insane. The logistics of travel, I won't spend a ton of time on it, but you watch Drive to Survive. I know I keep saying that, but it's the only way I can really convey. And you'll see like the bases they have at each race. They have these huge buildings of their headquarters for their race teams and everything like that. These things are all portable. They'll break down these, they call them motorhomes. They're not fucking motorhomes. They're these portable trailers that get parked together. Then they get constructed and have second floors put on them and extended. And then after race weekend, they have entire structure support teams that break it down and shuttle these things across Europe for the other races. They have, you know, they're having to send the same cars over. I think DHL, he said air freight. They break them down and send them over to these new locations for the next week's race, like the day of or the day after the other race is finished and they box stuff up and they're already traveling over there to put their garages together, fucking install all the computers, all the machinery, put the cars back together so they can fucking get to practice and qualifying on like Friday and Saturday.
Yeah, it's just like trying to travel, I'm sure, to set up like a concert.
Way more so because you have 10 teams, 20 cars, all these crews.
I mean, like each of them is doing their own concert as far as building a stage and everything like that. The car thing to me seems odd, moving them. So I feel like those you probably would never want to let out of your sight.
I'm sure they have representatives that are riding with this or people that they have as their like traveling, you know, managers that manage all the logistics just, for that.
Like, but keep their eyes on the cars the entire trip and don't ever take an eye off of them. Yeah. Because those things are, A, so much money, but B, if you get lost, if anything's late, if you put something in a trailer and then you can't fucking find that trailer. That's the biggest thing.
Like, what if, like, one of these ships that they're transferring all this, because they do some by ship freight and some by air freight. I'm like, what happens if, like, this plane gets diverted or, like, something happens?
Yeah. If you forget a gearbox somewhere.
They said there's been situations where they've wrecked somewhere like in Japan and their base was over in, I think he said Switzerland or Sweden, and like DHL is their travel partner, I guess. And they've called them up as soon as they saw a wreck happen and they're looking around, they're like, we don't have a spare one of those. It's back at the factory. Because they're only preparing for certain contingencies with travel costs and everything. And they've been like, we need this here tomorrow. And like, they'll fucking ship it. And there's specialized divisions within DHL that are like Formula One specific. And they'll get certain parts there like the next day. Jeez. It's fucking crazy. Like just the circus around it, the fucking characters, it makes you really more invested if you know kind of what goes on behind the scenes and what it takes for these guys. Seeing these fucking kids that don't even fucking shave yet or can't even legally buy beer, getting put in the cockpits, and these teams are like, don't wreck this multi-million-dollar fucking vehicle going 200 miles an hour around this track. Get at it, sport. And just, you know, their lifestyles and how they have to eat and live and breathe this from such a young age to try to reach the pinnacle of this. It's almost kind of like, it's the coolest version of fucking pageant moms that you could ever fucking think of, because that's what it is. I mean, they're just grooming these fucking kids to try to reach this peak. And, you know, there's no higher mountaintop. If you're looking for something to do, you know, even if you just want to check in on it, Netflix, Drive to Survive, great series. Start following the drivers now. ESPN has great information on it. But Formula One TV, you can get something specific for it. I'm hunting for sponsorships here. If any of you guys want to listen to this and throw us a contact, get us some pit passes. We can come down and take a look and do another episode on this shit.
Yeah.
I'm not above shameless promotion.
I'll be in on that. I didn't do that with wrestling, but I guess we can do that with F1.
Yeah, there you go. All right, guys. Well, if I missed anything, I apologize. If you want to hear anything about this, please get back to us. We'll see what we can do to try to work it into to maybe something else.
For sure.
But thanks for joining us on this fast-paced learning adventure.
Yeah, and don't tap the brakes on our episodes. Keep pumping that gas for us.
Oh, yeah, full bore, full clip, guys. All right. Well, thanks for listening again, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Peace.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for another episode. If you like what you heard, hit that subscribe and like button. Follow us. If you didn't like what you heard, still hit that anyway, because we'll probably cover something in the future that you do like. Please follow us on our social media. Adam, hit them with it.
Our Instagram is historicallyhighpod, historicallyhighpod, and we are on Twitter at historicallyhigh, that's historicallyhi.
All right. And if you guys want to send in any feedback, suggestions, hit us up on those two, or you can even do it on Gmail. It's historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.
Peace.